Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we have the lovely author Roxanne Bland, and her first novel, The Underground. Welcome, Roxanne.
Thank you very much, Sherry.
I'm really happy to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Tell us a bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I call myself a fugitive from reality. I'm a dreamer. I'm almost always daydreaming about people, places, things I'd like to do, things I've done. And in doing so, they kind of shape, they shape my books, because that's basically what I do. I take my daydreams and I write them down. Now, by day, I'm an attorney, so that makes it kind of hard to daydream, but daydreaming is a lot more fun.
I bet. And how did you start writing? I had read that it was fan fiction.
Well, yeah. Well, actually, I have been writing off and on since I was a kid. When I was in elementary school, a little story I wrote won first prize in a contest.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I wrote off and on short stories that never saw the light of day, which is probably a good thing. What happened was is that there were two strains of flu going around that winter. I caught both of them.
Oh, no.
And between the two, I was out of work for about a month. And, you know, when you get to the point where you're too sick to get up, but you're not too sick to sleep anymore, and you're bored.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I started writing this piece of fan fiction, and I didn't know what it was at the time, but I started writing this piece of fan fiction. And when I was well enough to go back to work, I think I wrote like 40 or 45 pages.
Wow.
And when I was well enough to go back to work, I showed it to a friend of mine who said, you know, you really ought to finish this. And I, what? She said, you really ought to finish this. This is good. So I said, okay. So I went home and I started writing. And then I started asking myself some questions, you know, based upon this piece of fan fiction I wrote.
Well,
and I asked,
fan fiction for what genre? Was it a TV show?
It was paranormal. It was paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
It was Laurel K. Hamilton's Anita Blake series,
mm-hmm.
the early books. And I started thinking about, well, what if they're not, you know, protected by the Constitution? What if they're still illegal? What do they do? How do they live? How do they get by? What do they do to keep themselves from being detected by humans? So I started asking myself all of these questions in that vein, and that gave me the basis for The Underground, my first book. And I started writing from there.
And do you have a particular love of certain authors that that sort of ignited that fire?
I can't say any particular author did, although I do love Edgar Allan Poe.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say there was any particular writer that ignited the passion in me. I think, to be honest with you, I think I always wanted to be a writer, but I just didn't know it at the time. For example, when I was a teenager, I was dead set on becoming a concert pianist. And, I mean, music was my life as far as I was concerned. But all during that time, I was doing a little bit of writing, a little bit of writing, a little bit of writing. And, you know, and I guess because since I had been writing since I was a child, it was kid stuff. You know, kids
yeah.
did this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And the adults who did it, you know, who were able to parlay it into a living, I think, well, you know, that's great for them. But, you know, this is kid stuff. So basically I stopped. I basically stopped writing, like I said, off and on, you know, when I was bored, I'd start writing little short stories and things like that. But no, I can't say there was any one particular author that ignited my passion for writing. It was just that when I started writing for myself, meaning when I started writing The Underground, it felt like I'd come home.
I understand. Do you, are you a big reader? Is that part of what you're, because you have to have like a influx of words, I think, to be a writer, whether it's
mm-hmm.
from life
mm-hmm.
or reading or movies or TV or whatever, but you have
mm-hmm.
to have some place to get the idea that, oh, that's where that comes from. So that's what
mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get at. Where did that push to write come from?
Well, when you put it that way, I guess it came from my reading. I'm a big reader, always have been. Never a big TV watcher, never a big moviegoer. Television, mainly because my sister, my older sister, who was bigger than all of us, had control over the television. And I didn't want to watch what she wanted to watch, so I read. And I read a lot as a child, and I think that's when I really kind of fell in love with words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what you could do with them, how you could stretch them. You can, you know, ball them like a rubber band or something like that. And you know, there are all sorts of things you can do with words. You know, they can be hurtful, they can be beautiful, they can be ugly. So I guess if you, like I said, you put it that way, I guess that's where it comes from, is my love of reading.
Do you have any authors you like?
Oh, gosh.
I know, it's
well,
a hard question for a reader, because I'm saying, well, about 200 different ones.
yeah. Well, I mentioned Edgar Allan Poe. I love Robert Heinlein. I didn't start getting into science fiction and fantasy really until I was in college, and I fell in love with Robert Heinlein. But I'd have to say one of my all-time favorite author has to be Tim Powers. He wrote a book called The Anubis Gates that will just blow your mind. And, I mean, the imagination this man has to weave all of these disparate elements together and make a cohesive story is just incredible. Basically, it's about a unassuming professor of Samuel Coleridge
mm-hmm.
who finds himself trapped in 19th century London as a result of this this millionaire, of course, billionaire these days, this millionaire schemes to live forever and involving Egyptian magic.
Hmm.
And I mean, like I said, it's all over the place, but he weaves it into a coherent whole. And I can't tell you how many times I've reread this book since I was in college. It's pretty dog-eared by now.
Well,
but I still have it.
That's my favorite thing about reading. It's what I think people that only read on an e-reader are missing out on. It's, you know, you can see everything in your book that you've, every
mm-hmm.
time you reread it, and you don't have that in an e-reader. You know,
that's
that lovely
true.
Dog-eared look.
Right, and the smell of paper.
Uh-huh, exactly.
Well, one thing I will say in favor of e-readers, I mean, I do have one, and one thing I will say in favor of e-readers is they're great for travel.
Yeah.
I mean,
I won't take away from that.
Yeah, I would, whenever I had to go on a business trip, I'd have 4 or 5 books with me, which made my backpack very heavy. Well, now I've just got the e-reader, and like I said, it makes life a lot simpler.
Yeah,
But even so, I find myself, whereas I can curl up with a book for hours and hours and hours and not look up. I can't do that with an e-reader.
You're staring at a screen. Your eyes, it affects your eyes a lot more than staring at a book. Books are gentler on the eye than a screen.
I suppose that's it.
I think that's it, at least for me. I mean, yeah, I read on computers all the time, and I read on my cell and all that stuff. But the screen, actually, after a while, you realize, oh, my God, my eyes are just tearing. But for a book, I could read the book for hours, and it wouldn't bother me.
Hmm.
At least that's the way I feel about it.
Yeah, well, you're probably right. I mean, it certainly sounds logical enough. Because it certainly would explain why when I use my e-reader, I pick it up and put it down and pick it up and put it down, whereas I know if it were paper, I'd sit there and read the whole thing,
right.
You know, one sitting.
I mean, I found myself losing time because I write in the morning, and then at night before I go to bed, I always read a book. And
mm-hmm.
I go to bed at like 11 and I end up going to sleep at 1 because I'm so into what I'm reading.
Mm-hmm.
You don't realize it.
That's true. That's very true. That is very true. How many nights have I stayed up all night? One more chapter.
Exactly. And you're like, oh, I gotta know what happens next.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up like ending in the middle of a chapter because there's sort of a break because at the end of the chapter, they always have it jumping into the next thing, and you're like,
right.
Oh, I got to find out what happens, you know?
Right.
Do you
absolutely
read while you're writing? Because I do. And some people won't because they're worried that it'll influence what they're writing. I personally don't, but how do you feel about that?
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
Do you read while you're working on a book?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are writers who are afraid that it will influence them if they read. See, I don't understand that personally, but that's how they feel. So, I mean, I totally respect it, but
right.
I don't really understand it.
I mean, what are you supposed to do when you're not writing?
Right.
You read.
Yeah. I mean, that's me. I devour books. I just love them.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That doesn't mean I'm going to copy them. When I write from my own imagination.
Right.
So I just don't get it.
And another book might be a jumping off point.
Yeah.
You just take it in a whole different direction.
Yeah, exactly. Like when I wrote my book, Fantasy Time Inc., I have to say I was deeply influenced by The Time Machine and by a Star Trek episode called On the Edge of Forever. But believe me, my book
mm-hmm.
has nothing to do with either of those. It just said, oh, yeah, yeah, oh, yeah, okay. I want to do a time travel story.
Well, everybody's influenced by somebody else. I mean, it depends on what you do with it. What's your angle? What's your twist? So, you know, I mean, who was it that said there's nothing new under the sun?
I don't know.
But
yeah, it's an old saying.
Right. But the thing is that if you give it your own twist, then it is kind of new.
Exactly.
That does make it new.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. Do you love history?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. One of my favorite authors is Barbara Tuchman. She wrote The Guns of August. That was her first book about World War I. The First Salute, which was about the First Nations to recognize America after the War for American Independence. She writes beautiful, beautiful stuff. My other author that I like is Ferdinand Braudel. He's French. He's passed on now. But he wrote about, one of the things he wrote about was medieval Europe, and not from the perspective of the kings and queens, but of the peasants, which was fascinating, you know, getting into their lives, which was just absolutely fascinating. So, yeah, I am a big history reader. You know, I'm usually reading fiction, but I will delve into, in fact, I just found a book today I'd like to pick up. It's about the war in North Africa during World War II, which I don't know a whole lot about.
Oh yeah, Rommel. Desert Fox.
Yeah, besides him.
My father was a big history buff, so I kind of have that. I have a really deep love of history, but I have also a deep love of mythology, and I'm afraid sometimes in my imagination it gets all messed up. I mean, I know which is which, but I just,
mm-hmm.
but when I'm thinking about it, it just mixes up with each other.
Hey, write it down. That sounds great.
A
mythological history?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
See, now you've given me an idea.
That's the way it's supposed to work.
Exactly.
I mean, I love to use history and mythology and fan fiction and all that. I'm not, like I said, just because you're influenced by it doesn't mean you're using it like a plagiarist.
Mm-hmm.
It ignites your imagination. You go, ooh. Like, I wrote a fan fiction story recently because I was watching the History Channel and they were talking about Nordic mythology, and I was like, ooh, that's a really interesting thing. And I started writing a story from that. But I'm not doing anything. I'm just taking my own imagination and using
mm-hmm.
the gods and goddesses from Nordic mythology.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, may in fact actually turn into something later on down the road. See, that's the beauty of writing. You know, sometimes you just write just to write, and you never know what ideas are going to, you know, some you discard, obviously, but you never know which ideas are going to turn into something.
Absolutely.
And that's what I love about it.
I think that that's the most fun of it, to be totally honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's why it's fun to write. That's
Absolutely.
The joy of it.
Absolutely.
Give us a taste of the best part of your book and what you'd like the readers to take away from it.
Well, actually, I think the best part of my book is the subplot.
Hmm.
And I wrote it the way, well, Let me reverse those. What I'd like to take for the reader to take away from my book is that it's been shown in history over and over and over again. If you push and mistreat and persecute a people hard enough, they will push back, sometimes violently, sometimes peacefully, but they will push back.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did was, in the subplot of my book, is a planned revolution of paranormals against human oppression.
That's interesting.
And of course, in the subplot, the folks are doing it, you know, the violent way. In the main plot, they're using... a mage and a werewolf and a vampire, they're using magic in order to accomplish the same end, the peaceful end and the violent end. And the two do meet. They end up meeting, but not in the way anybody expects.
That's interesting. That's an interesting way to get about to the conclusion of your story. I like it when everything ties together. It's kind of interesting because you never know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because sometimes they seem so separate, and you're like, how is it going to all tie up? You know,
you know, that's what one of my betas told me, my beta readers told me, you know, I was wondering how you were going to wrap this up.
Yeah, that's you're reading the book, and you're like, oh, okay, how are you going to end this? How are you going to bring the two points together? You know, that's part of the fun of it.
She said it wasn't until the last, now my chapters in the underground are short, but so she said it wasn't until the last 10 chapters or so that I finally saw where you might be going with this. I had to laugh, and I just looked at her and I said, good, that's the whole point.
Yep, that's how you do it, absolutely. What's your biggest satisfaction in completing it?
Oh, you know, what I felt once I had completed the manuscript and once I had it published, I had this incredible feeling of relief.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because it was my first book and I'd worked so hard on it for so long, and sometimes it seemed like it would never be published. But I felt relief. And I also felt joy, you know, that here is something that I did in tangible form. It's a book.
It's my
and it's
baby.
It's a lot, you know, and I've heard it compared to giving birth to a child.
It's my baby.
And it is very much like that.
Yep.
It is very much like that, except my labor was incredibly long.
Yeah, I know. Mine too. But it's just, yeah, it's just like, which book do you, I have two books, and they're like, which book do you like? I'm like, it's like asking me which child I like better, you know.
I know.
They're both to my heart, so I'm sorry, I can't tell you which I like better.
Really, I love them both equally.
Exactly, yeah. It's so much, it's like people that don't write also say, when are you going to write a sequel? I'm like, well, right now I don't feel it, so no, I'm not writing a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I'm writing a sequel to The Underground.
Well, that's great.
That's what I'm working on now. It's a sequel because there are some, I'll call them unanswered questions. There are some, let's just call them unanswered questions. You know, if you think about it, you know, after you get, you know, after you finish it, if you think about it, there are still some issues that, you know, my characters have with each other, with their situation. And the question is, you know, what do we do about that? So I'm busy writing the sequel now, and hopefully that'll be finished by the end of the year.
Well, that is like one of the interesting things. It's like, well, I always use her because she's like what right now my total favorite, but J.K. Rowling, she
mm-hmm.
had the entire book of Harry Potter, the whole series, all seven books, all mapped out in her head. Even though she hadn't written it, she had it all mapped out. But that's the way she conceived it.
Right.
So then there are people that are just like, oh, there's more to the story after they finish, and they start
mm-hmm.
writing a sequel. I mean, everybody's different.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you already have it mapped out, or did it just come to the end and say, you know, there's more to do?
I realized about three-quarters of the way through writing the book that there was going to be a sequel. Now, whether it goes beyond that, I don't know. See, because I don't write with an outline. When you tell me write an outline, I freeze. And I guess it's because I remember writing outlines when I was in school and I absolutely hated it.
Me too.
So, yeah. So,
I mean, I have notes and notes and notes and notes, but I don't write an outline.
Exactly. And they call it being a pantser as opposed to a plotter. I prefer the term organic.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
And it just kind of, you know, I write where I go where the story takes me.
I also think that it's, well, if you're a character-driven person like me,
mm-hmm.
It's better to go with the flow of how the characters are going to go than to
mm-hmm.
try to plot it out. I mean, you have a structure of the book, and that's what your notes are, but to say, okay, well, I'm going to put this point B and then point C and then point D, and you're like, well, the character only wants to go to point D. They don't want to go to the other point, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to go with where the character wants to go. So that's
exactly.
I'm quite organic myself.
I let the characters write the book.
Exactly.
And
that way too.
And they seem to enjoy that. And I enjoy. Okay, what are you going to do next?
Yeah, because then you're surprised too.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes they do take some surprising twists.
Yeah.
And it's like, wait a minute, you're not supposed to do that. And they look at me and say, why not?
Exactly. Yeah, people don't get that. They're like, well, aren't you the character? And you're like, not really.
Mm-mm.
It's like some hidden part of your imagination.
Right. And all you can do is run with it.
Yep. Did you self-publish or did you go through a publisher?
I self-published. What I did was I started my own publishing company.
Hmm.
And I did it because I was on my next round of going to submit to publishers. I'd gone through all the agents. And I was on my, you know, gearing up to submit to publishers. And it dawned on me that this is what I want to do when I retire from my day job.
Mm-hmm.
I want to, well, I mean, I'm going to do it anyway. I mean, I'm going along with it. I mean, it'll probably remain a sideline until I retire, which will be early, I hope. And but I want to write and I want to publish books. This is what I want to do with my time. And so because of that, I decided to go ahead and start a little publishing company and publish my first book under its imprint. So it's called Black Rose Press.
Cool.
And, you know, now I'm not taking anybody else's submissions at this time.
Right.
But, you know, maybe as time goes on and I have a better idea of what I'm doing, I do not have a publishing industry background, obviously. When I have a better idea of what I'm doing and how the business really works, I'll start taking other submissions. But right now, it's just my just publishing my own book. So, yeah, I am self-published. And and, you know, proud to say it. You know, I don't think there's any stigma for being self-published, at least not for me.
Not for me either, but from the publisher. Like, if you're self-published, it's really hard to go to a publisher. There's still a prejudice there. I think it's stupid because, you know, there's some self-published books that are bestsellers, so...
Right.
And if you look back in history, a lot of people that went through self-publishing, such as Jane Austen, she self-published her first book, Sense and Sensibility. Agatha Christie, she self-published her first book, which was a Perot.
The Mysterious Affairs at Styles.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you. Blanked out for a minute. It shouldn't be a stigma because it's been happening for centuries since the press started and people started reading books. So I don't really understand why they're acting this way, but that's the way they're still acting.
Well, I wonder if a lot of it had to do with the rise of the vanity presses.
There's a fear there.
And maybe that's the cause, or maybe it's something that they did in order to, you know, keep themselves as the gatekeepers.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, after all, they're the ones they're big enough to be able to influence opinion.
Yeah, but the problem is that they're like a lot of the things that they're pushing. They're like pushing reality stars writing books. I mean,
oh, I know.
I mean, it's kind of sad.
Well,
we don't
they're
have
pushing.
A, oh,
go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, they're pushing what's going to make money.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not. I mean, there are some brilliant authors out there, you know, who can't get a foot in the door because these guys are more interested in publishing, you know, Kim Kardashian's book
or Snooki. Yeah.
Or Snooki. Oh, my God. When I heard she wrote a book, I was just, oh, geez.
Yeah, sad. We don't have much time left. I want to thank you for a wonderful interview. Next week, we're going to have the producer-writer Paul Jackson, who's best known for Sliders, Lois and Clark, and Briscoe County Jr. I'm really excited to have him. I want my live audience to thank Roxanne for such a lovely interview, and I want to thank you. Thank you, Roxanne.
Thank you, Sherry.
And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Thanks again.
Thank you.